Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, and happy 4th of July to you. This is Donna Sebo. Welcome to an hour of mind power, but I'd like to shift that a little bit. Mind power is very important. Everything begins with a thought. But I want to shift to a different level of understanding this morning, because as we're celebrating this holiday, which is in honor of peace, freedom, everything that the American spirit holds dear, it's really important for us to remember this did not come about because somebody waved a magic wand. It came about because a lot of people decided to break through paradigms that in that time of history was almost unthinkable. It was not something that was easy to do. And when you study history, it becomes fascinating how that reality seems to be repeating itself in a new way today. I want to welcome to the show a man, Paul Chappelle, who has a fascinating background, but more than that, his book, The Art of Waging Peace, I thought was so significant, especially on this holiday, that we are celebrating the rights of freedom that we just sort of take for granted today. That it wasn't that long ago. They weren't available in many, many aspects. I want to welcome to the show Paul Chappelle. Paul, your book, The Art of Waging Peace, is, in my estimation, and I told you this before we came on air, extremely impressive. And it's taken me more time than I anticipated to read your material because you have so much in it that is mentally, one, challenging, two, bringing forth facts of history. And it said if we don't know history, we cannot know how to deal with how to make our lives better, which I think is very true. And three, your candor about how important it is to wage peace. And yesterday on television, broadcast around the world, we saw how millions of people in Egypt said, we will not accept, and this is my word, not their word, we will not accept slavery. We will not accept an oppressive government. And they stood up for it. And they're in a very critical position in here as a population. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now, I want my listeners to know that you graduated from West Point in 2002. You were deployed to Baghdad, and you were left active. You left active duty in November 2009. You were a captain. You decided that you were going to put together a series of books. And this one, The Art of Waging Peace, is a very powerful one. In your own words, Paul, how did your training at West Point and your experience in Baghdad make you decide you wanted to teach people how to wage peace?
Well, at West Point, one concern I had and one concern a lot of people in the military have is they care about the country being safe, and they care about national security, and they, if you listen to President Obama or President Bush, any American president, they all talk about how the U.S. military is spreading freedom and democracy around the world. And I found that waging peace is the best way to do that, that waging peace is more effective than waging war at keeping our country safe, keeping the world safe, promoting democracy and freedom, and solving these problems we have today. So I think that my priority is still the priority I had many years ago, but waging peace is the more effective method.
You're a man that is highly educated. You obviously, in this book, The Art of Waging Peace, are a very deep thinker. You've done a lot of research. You've gone back into history, history that we have recorded thousands of years old. But a lot of people, when they hear you speaking, because we're not on television, are not aware that you have what I would describe as a mixed genetic background, which I think is a phenomenal blessing. You also grew up in Alabama,
right,
which is a cultural environment all of itself. You had a half-black, half-white father who fought in the Korean and Vietnam Wars, and you had a Korean mother. And you experienced so many things as you were growing up that I think helped you realize that to change people's thinking about belief systems that maybe they have adopted is a learned talent, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so for example, 200 years ago in America, women couldn't vote, women couldn't own property, women couldn't go to college. Attitudes towards slavery and race were much different 200 years ago. And even attitudes toward interracial marriage, it was illegal in many states in the up until the end of the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And if any American politician today were to say that we should bring back slavery, bring back segregation, women shouldn't be able to vote their own property, people would look at that person like he's insane. But 200 years ago, almost every American thought that way, and the vast majority, virtually every politician spoke that way. And so attitudes have dramatically changed, and I'm living proof that attitudes can change. And you're living proof as a woman, and doing what you're doing now. You're living proof that things can change. And we have a long way to go. There's many problems we still have to take care of as Americans and as human beings. But if we've come this far, why can't we keep moving in a positive direction? And waging peace is the best method to continue making progress on many of these issues.
I think yesterday when I was observing on the news the live filming. We live in an era where people from around the world can communicate with us instantaneously, and it's just a phenomenon that's relatively recent. To see these millions of people standing up and saying, what we elected in is not appropriate. We are not slaves. And again,
right,
those are my words. We are not slaves. We are standing up for this. We are making a choice. We put you in, we can take you out. And I heard a statement made, and it was by one of the commentators, that apparently the military had tried to use very, very oppressive tactics not too long ago in controlling the Egyptian population, and the population, which was substantially larger than they were, turned on them. And my husband and I were discussing this, and I think I said, you know, when you look at the country of China, there are far more people in the country of China than there are soldiers. And when you look at their history, when people have rebelled, there's been mass slaughter. This is something that has been done. And there's a cultural patterning that historically has dominated, and it's one of fear. And it's come, you know, especially since the period of Mao. And where the population, the density of population, could have done what the Egyptians did with the military, and not too long ago, the military actually said, we can't do this because we're going to be slaughtering people. Yes, we've got weapons, but they're not going to put up with it. And so here's this coup that occurred in Egypt, and the military said, we'll support it. This is what we're going to be on the side of the people. This was incredibly powerful. And I thought, boy, if the same thing happened in China, and if the same thing happened in India, which when Gandhi was alive, there were these nonviolent protests. Sadly, some of them didn't stay that way. But when they were that way, the changes that were implemented were just phenomenal. And that's what you're trying to promote, isn't it?
Yes. It's this new technique that confronts the opponent, the system, not at their strongest point, which is their military, but their weakest point, which is their moral authority. And if you use violence against violence, and they have the stronger violent power, you're fighting at their strongest point, but nonviolence is this asymmetric way to confront the system at the moral point, which is typically the weakest point of an unjust system.
In the history that you relate in this book, I really appreciated the details and information that you brought out from The Art of War, which is centuries old. And one of the lessons that was taught was, if someone is a leader, they have to not put themselves above anybody else, but they need to know they have to be right there in the midst of those people that they're working with, having integrity with that. And this is something I am hearing. I've interviewed numbers of people on my show that have been leaders of different businesses, and they say, this is so important. You always live your life with integrity. You must understand you have to be the example, because the attitude at the top permeates the entire organization. And there are so many aspects in our country, in the United States of America, as well as throughout the world, because of our communication capacity, where we are finding out the truth is coming out, the lies, the deceptions, the propaganda, if you will.
Right.
All of this is coming about so significantly. And one of the things that you're saying is we have to look at an approach that's different from some of the attitudes that have been permeated for years. And I think this is healthy. What have you discovered in your research regarding, for example, the art of discernment and communication?
Yes, so one thing I write about is how most human conflict comes from people feeling disrespected. The vast majority of human conflict comes from people feeling disrespected. And if you think about the times in your life when you were most angered by somebody, it probably was because in some way you felt that they had disrespected you. And this is one reason why martial arts teaches to always respect everybody, including your opponent, is because the vast majority of human conflict comes from people feeling disrespected. And martial arts teaches that the best self-defense is not knowing how to punch or kick well, it's knowing how to convey respect. And if you think of all of human history, I don't think anyone has ever seriously said, I hate it when people respect me. I can't stand it when people respect me. Everybody likes to be respected. Now, most disrespect, though, comes from miscommunication and misunderstanding. And in our culture, we're not really taught how to communicate all that well, in the sense that we're not taught how to communicate in ways that allow us to resolve conflict. We're not taught many of these important life skills, how to convey respect, how to calm people down, how to listen, how to be a good friend, how to resolve conflict, as I was saying earlier. And so not only are we not taught these valuable life skills, but those skills are also waging peace skills. If you look at Martin Luther King Jr. or Gandhi, such a powerful tool of waging peace is listening, understanding, the ability to cultivate empathy, the ability to communicate, the ability to dialogue and transform how people think and persuade people on controversial issues. So I think that we have to really understand these tools and put them into action, not just for our personal lives, but also to make our communities and our country and the world better.
I really appreciated your comments about how historically, if you want to conquer a people, what you want to do is dominate their minds. And any time, and I have said this so many times to people, if you are not willing to read, if you are not willing to be open to learning, if you think where you are is the absolute, God bless you, do it. But that means you're going to give yourself over to someone else because you don't have enough diversity in your thinking to know how to question. And this is something I had to learn. I wasn't taught this. I had to learn it. And you bring this out very poignantly in your book, how in history, anyone that wanted to conquer a nation, let's say, the first thing they did was destroy rights in the sense of we are going to control what you read, we're going to control what's good for you, what isn't good for you. It's like we know what's best for you. You couldn't possibly know what's best for yourself. After all, you're just some ignorant, you know, ding-dong down here, and you're not in my positioning of power. This is something that it permeates history. And when people acquiesce to that, this is something that is going to cause a total removal of any freedoms or rights that you have. And part of American history, like our very renowned Benjamin Franklin, who made sure that information was out in the press. That's one of the reasons he became such a wealthy man. He got involved in the business of communication, and he challenged. He wasn't afraid to challenge, and he was always learning. He was always doing something new. He's just one of many. So you have these people that in this country, many of them were indentured servants. Many of them didn't make any difference what their culture was, what their ethnicity was. It just was a fact. It was a pretty tough environment because the British were the dominant culture at the time. So here you've got these people that say, wait a minute, I don't have to do what was done before. I can do it differently. And they had to stand up for the right to do that. But you have to be awake enough to do it. And there were many people at that time that really said, well, we're comfortable. We really don't want to make any waves here. Let's keep on with the old stuff. It's fine with me. It's not uncomfortable. But the reality is there were those that saw the bigger picture. And that is at the base of what created the Constitution. And there were tremendous battles over that. And you bring out in your book how the reframing of attitudes and understanding can be done, but you don't have to be hitting people over the head with it. You can communicate an understanding. And by golly, with all of the wars that are going on throughout the world, I think it's about time that somebody wakes up to this. And there's a lot of people to have. They said, we've got to do a better way. Waging war is going to destroy our nation. It's going to break us economically. You bring this out in the book.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. In the 21st century, we live in this mass media world where we have to use a different method now. We have to, for example, when civilians are killed on foreign soil because of mass media, because of camera technology and YouTube and Internet, it's very easy to spread those images and create additional hatred against the country that has inflicted those civilian casualties. So if the U.S., for example, kills people with drones, that can increase animosity and hatred toward us. Just as if people killed Americans on our soil, it would mm-hmm. do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And the power comes through greater awareness, education, reading. And if people doubt the power of reading or doubt the power of education, they should ask themselves, why did slave owners make it illegal for slaves to learn how to read? Why did the Nazis burn and ban books? Why did dictators ban books? Because it's physically impossible for a handful of people, it's physically impossible for a small handful of people to control millions upon millions of people. You have to first control how they think. You have to first oppress their minds, use propaganda. And once that propaganda fails and people start questioning, then you have, for example, what happened in Egypt or what happened in the civil rights movement or what happened in the women's rights movement.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's very important. I think that is exceedingly important. I think having, and I'll use the popular word that the politicians like to bandy about, but they don't live up to, transparency. There is power in that. There is tremendous power in that. And this is something that you bring out. I really feel that your stories in the book, and I respected the fact that you brought out information about Frederick Douglass you write about Malcolm X. Most people, when they hear Malcolm X, it's like they remember all of the bad stuff. But they don't realize that at the end of his life, he acknowledged how the choices and actions that he made and took really were not appropriate.
Right.
And I thought, this is so powerful because we have so much propaganda out there that there are groups of people that want to nourish the hate. They want it. It feeds whatever it is that they're wanting to cultivate. And that is, to me, again, the positioning of, I know more than you do. So you've got to understand, this has to be the bad person. We've got to really put this person down. We're going to demonize this person. And it's an aspect that I think is very disturbing about media. I've been involved in media for so much of my life, and I've seen both sides of it. Actually, there's multiple sides. It's more like a hexagon. And you look at this, and you go, where is the integrity? Where is the honesty? People are beating their own drums. And that is why it's very important to question, where is the information coming from? Why is this being promoted so much? What is somebody covering up to distract from what really needs to be taken care of? It really is a whole different space of thinking. And unless someone has a chance to be in an environment where people promote this, like Socrates did, that was what he was known for, discourse, communication. Let's talk about these things. Let's put it out on the table. Let's get the facts out. Where do we get the information? This is really a challenging discipline. It's not an easy discipline to utilize at all. And you give a very good example in your book about a man in a positioning, and there was a commanding officer that was just out in left field with his attitudes, and I believe this was one of your stories.
Yes, just the ability to listen, and this change in attitude comes from primarily from within, and that can spread out from there. And these tools that we can cultivate for waging peace can impact not just our lives, but the lives of others as well.
You talk about a lot relative to the military, because this has been a very strong influence. Give us a little bit of history about West Point. I, like many others, think that this is a military college, but that's not the case.
Yes,
tell us what it really was established as, and its positioning. It really is not a military college.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about West Point. It was founded originally as the country's first engineering school to train a specific branch of the military, which were the Corps of Engineers, which were kind of back then a different kind of part of the military. And they weren't training all active duty officers. They were training specifically engineers. And its foundation was really upon science, engineering, math, and a lot of these kind of classical ideals and humanist ideals. And General MacArthur turned it into a liberal arts college. And so it's a military college, but it's also a liberal arts and an engineering college. And during the academic year, the focus is heavily on academics. The military training is mostly in the summertime, although you do live in military style. You have military style regulations, standards, living accommodations, organizational structure, but it is as much an engineering and liberal arts college and academic institution as it is a military institution.
What do you think, after being at West Point and being in Baghdad, having served over there, how did your education benefit you? And what were some of the greatest lessons you learned?
Well, West Point taught me to think critically, and it taught me to use my mind because the military walks a fine line in a sense that if soldiers can't question at all or think, you end up with atrocities. You end up with the My Lai massacre in the Vietnam War, or you end up with the Nazis. And so although the American military has to be subservient to civilian authority, soldiers have to be able to think to some extent. And so when I was in Iraq, I questioned a lot of things, and even before then. And I think that a lot of the tools West Point gave me, by giving me a well-rounded education, for example, mm-hmm. gave me some framework to really see things from a different perspective.
In Baghdad, being actively engaged in an environment of war, with everything that is told us, for you as a soldier, what were the greatest lessons you learned in that activity?
There were several. Foremost in my mind was, we have to find another way to solve these problems. And also, I saw the disconnect between the American public and the war in many ways, where if the American government had had a draft the way that it had during the Vietnam War, then there would have been much more public opposition to the Iraq War. We probably wouldn't have gone. And people in power know that. That's why there isn't a draft anymore. And I saw how there were more civilian contractors in Iraq than there were soldiers, and how the nature of war had been changing, but also how the kinds of problems we're dealing with now, the military solution, we just have to innovate and think of other ways to work toward these solutions in ways that violence simply can't accomplish.
And a significant point that you bring out, which I think is historically repeating itself out of infinitum, and especially today, is that the average person of any people, they want peace. They do not want to go to war. And it's important for individuals to know that they should speak up and speak out, because there is an economic side to war. And there was a gentleman that you mentioned in your book that wrote in 1933, "War is a racket." And I thought, wow, that is something I've never heard about. Of course, it was written in 1933, so that it sort of explains it. But I really think to myself, here is someone that saw the horrors of war and was someone that was intelligent and analyzed it. And one of the things that you show in your book, and when the art of waging peace, when one goes through it, it is something that provokes thinking. It's something that makes you wake up to the reality that each of us have a level of responsibility in learning how to think, in studying history, and in understanding we can speak out, but we don't have to arm ourselves with a machine gun. We don't have to buy into the propaganda that so often is promoted through various movies or conversations that people will say, yes, let's do this. It's not a glorious thing. It's not something that, when you look at the results, all anybody has to do is go into a VA hospital and see it. There's got to be a better way. And that is what I think your book, The Art of Waging Peace, is a huge step towards that objective. And I compliment your courage in publishing it. And I'm very grateful that this was brought to my attention, because I think it is, as you say on the cover of your book, a strategic approach to improving our lives and making this world a better place. Paul, you have a website that people can go to, peacefulrevolution.com. What will they find on that website?
At peacefulrevolution.com, they'll find more about the book, The Art of Waging Peace, the other books. They'll find videos, and I offer leadership training, specifically peace leadership training. Right now, I'm the peace leadership director for the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. So it's a way for people to get more information, look at some interviews, read some more, and learn more about waging peace.
Paul, it has been absolutely a delight having you as a guest today on this very significant holiday of July the 4th. And your message is a powerful one. And it is one that presents information in a way, giving perspectives that I think so many of us do not, because of our lifestyles and our responsibilities, have often an opportunity to really know about. Thank you so much for being my guest. And for those of you listening, check out peacefulrevolution.com. And you might want to add this book to your library. And if you have kids in school, if you want to teach them a little bit about history, not just American history, but history of other nations relative to war and peace, the art of waging peace will give you a lot of those connections. Again, Paul, thank you. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Thank you, Donna. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We see it every day. Courts overflowing with frivolous lawsuits. People losing all of their assets simply because they were unprepared. The best defense against unscrupulous predators and creditors is a good offense. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes and from all over the world create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Think asset protection is only for the wealthy? Think again. Our Cover Your Assets strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Industry leader Corporate Direct is owned and operated by attorney and best-selling author Garrett Sutton. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can tailor a CYA plan for you. That's CYA, Cover Your Assets, with Corporate Direct. 1-800-600-1760. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are open, and happy 4th of July to you. 888-627-6008. Well, I wanted to share a little bit of information with you. Oh, by the way, I have a wonderful story about a U.S. gold winner at the Olympics, and it's about Gabby. Gabby Douglas. And I started to tell you the story yesterday, but we ran out of time, so I'll be sure to share that one with you today. She's a very beautiful young woman. But before I do that, I was chatting with a friend not very long ago, and today she is flying to Paris. Yes. Oh, she's so excited. It's her very first time at going to Europe. So I thought I would just share. Here we are in the midst of summer. And it's something that maybe you're getting ready to travel or you're going to be doing different things. And if you're going overseas, like my friend is, and I can hardly wait to hear about her adventures when she gets back. She's going to be gone for about a month. These are some tips. One, travel with one bank ATM card and one credit card. And this comes from the AAA because they say it'll give you some flexibility while minimizing the number of financial institutions you'll need to contact if anything is stolen from you. Also, make sure your debit and credit cards are set to 4-digit PIN numbers. I've got some other little tips I'll share with you. We've got a caller on the line. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling in from?
Oh, good morning, Donna. This is Lisa from Anchorage.
Oh, hi, Lisa. Happy 4th of July.
Well, thank you. And you as well.
I hope you've got some sunshine up there on this glorious day.
Just liquid.
Oh, liquid, huh? It's raining.
We had a good June, though. We had 80-degree weather, so we're paying for it now a little bit.
Oh, my goodness. 80 degrees in Anchorage in June. Oh, my word. That's unreal. Oh, my.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can imagine. You wouldn't have been able to find anybody. They would have all been out fishing or in their gardens or someplace else. It's because that is not all that common. So, oh, my goodness. Well, let's get down to business with you, Lisa. The first thing that I am aware of with you is I want you to take care of yourself, dear. I'm just feeling so tired. I feel like the center of my body is depleted. And basically what you need is rest. And when I say that, it's not just sleeping. It's like being able to separate yourself from a lot of pressure. And you need to make it okay to find what I'd call a safe, secure environment someplace. Maybe you go and get a motel room for a day, a month, or something. But you need to do something that allows you to rejuvenate yourself, to bring the harmony of the body into balance. Because you've got a lot that's pressing down on you, and you're a very responsible person. You are going to do whatever you have to do. But this fatigue has to be dealt with. So take care of yourself. Because when you are well-rested, and sometimes it's just a psychological resting, maybe what you need to do is just watch some Disney cartoons. Watch Goofy or Donald Duck or something. Just to shift into a place where you're not preoccupied mentally. Because you need to bring yourself back into harmony. You are clearing out of your life a lot of what I call excess debris. And you're doing it conscientiously and patiently, although you would like to take a bulldozer to it, you realize that's not going to get everything done. Mm-hmm. And you want to pay attention to the details, whether it is financial or anything else, taking care of the details, getting rid of certain things that need to be just put into their proper positioning and just closed out. That is what you need to do. And you're going to be doing it very well, but you do need to be in that position of harmony and balance so that you can work more effectively. But this fatigue, I just look at it and, I just feel such almost a heaviness, but it's like I've got a big hole inside of me. And you need to take care of yourself. You need to be aware, be gentle with you, so that you can do what you want to do. Stop beating yourself up over things that, it's just not worth it. Do you have a question for me?
Yeah, I'm in a job transition, and it wasn't voluntary. I left because I was working under contract, and I'm not getting a warm, fuzzy feeling where that contract was going. And so I took this new job, and it's totally out of place with the people and the responsibilities, and I have the opportunity to go back to where I had a more pleasant work environment, but I still have this fear that, well, I have a job now and the other one is not very secure, and I'm wondering but you're totally right about the fatigue and the clearing out in all aspects of my life about that, but I'm wondering if you're getting any impressions about this work situation.
Well, the work situation I'm looking has a number of sides to it. And the most significant aspect is in the environment that you have chosen to step into, there are many different things you can learn from it. And a lot of it you are absorbing now. And I'd like for you to take a pad of paper and divide it down the middle. This is a very simple exercise. And look at the positives of having a job. And then look at what you perceive the negatives. Part of the negatives that you're feeling is that you are feeling constricted. You are not being encouraged to be original in thinking. You are to conform to an established paradigm, and you're looking at it and you're going, well, this could be changed and that could be changed and the other could be changed. So this is in part of what is choking you mentally. But you need to be able to look at it with a clarity. Then you need to look at the other situation, which, again, they'll take you back in a minute. It's not an issue about the security factor. That is always going to be a challenge in that environment as an independent contractor. It is just something that you're going to have to deal with. But if you are honest about that contracting position, you look again, have another piece of paper, write down the positives of it and the negatives of it, and look at the negatives. The negative aspect that you would need to deal with if you opted to go back into that environment is going back into it and setting some of your own paradigms, establishing boundaries. Maybe that's a better word for me to use, saying, if I come back, if I'm going to work with you, we have to have an understanding, and I want it in writing, and you need to be clear about it. Part of what you are beginning to put aside is this feeling of helplessness. You are not helpless. It is part of the thinking that many times women have been indoctrinated with. Men can be indoctrinated too. But there is an environment of thought that you have adopted, and it's not good or bad. Everybody has to work through this. Do I want to have more of my own choice expressed in this independent contract positioning? And if so, how can I achieve this? How do I present myself? So it's very, very clearly stated in a written statement, a contract statement, that this is acceptable and this is not acceptable. If that's not possible with the contract, and you choose to stay in the job that you have at this time, which isn't bad. It isn't bad at all. You need to understand if you take the positioning that you have and stay with it, then you need to ask yourself, what can you gain? What can you learn? What opportunities do you have in front of you that you can utilize before you choose to go back into an environment for independent contracting? And that is where I see your challenge. Mm-hmm. That's what you need to think through and then make your decision, not coming from a positioning of being afraid of not having an income, being afraid of not having benefits. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to really look with clarity at what's in front of you.
Yeah.
Does that help you, dear?
Yeah. You hit the nail on the head, most definitely.
Well, I just am so grateful for you calling in. Stop beating yourself up. Stop beating yourself up. This, in many ways, is a gift to you.
Yeah.
Because it's helping you to recognize that you've got more ability than you could ever imagine. It's a recognition of yourself, my dear.
Okay.
And if you should decide you want to call me and talk about it more in depth, then just know I'm a phone call away.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Lisa. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break shortly. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Eleanor Vincent, swimming with Maya. This is a story about her daughter and her and their life and the changes that affected them both. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break for just a moment. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
Too many people become victims of frivolous lawsuits and scammers simply because they were unprepared. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Asset protection is not only for the wealthy. Our strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can help you. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top of the line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Yesterday, and the telephone number if you want to call in, 888-627-6008. Yesterday, I had started sharing with you a story about an Olympic champion. She's an absolutely beautiful, beautiful young woman, and she won 2 gold medals at the London Olympics, and she is just an incredible young woman, and her story I thought was quite significant, and I really wanted to share it with you because I feel it's representative of what we in the United States really, really believe in, and that is if you work hard enough, if you're willing to try, if you're willing to go and give your best, you have just as good a chance of being a champion as anyone else does. And she is a good example of this. I found her story quite interesting. She said that when she was born, her mother had a terrible delivery, was just really in a very, very difficult time. And she said, I was so tiny, they didn't even know that I was going to live. She ended up becoming very, very ill. She would just scream out in pain. And her parents had no money. They were out of work. They actually had to live in a van with both her and their other children. In fact, the family, the only food they had to eat was peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Now, she couldn't. Her body could not work with the food as she got older. She couldn't keep anything down. She was just so very, very thin. And, of course, the family was very anxious about her. They found out when they finally were able to put a little bit of money together, when they were able to get a blood test on her, that she had ketoacidoria. And this is a metabolic disorder where the body cannot process certain amino acids. Protein. Her little tiny body just wasn't able to do it well. Well, her mother was a woman of deep faith, and during the difficult times when this beautiful child, Gabby, was really having to fight for her life, she would just, through prayer and her own faith, she'd hold her and just rock her until the moment passed. Well, finally, when the family was in a positioning to be able to afford to go to a doctor, which I hadn't been able to do for a long time, somehow or another, the body managed to heal itself. And the family ended up living in Virginia. Mom worked multiple jobs. Dad was a reservist in the Virginia Air National Guard. And it was so hard because he was sent overseas. Her mother and father eventually divorced. And so Mom had responsibilities that were just multiplied, as every single parent usually ends up with. And Gabby was one of these very active kids. Now, she was small. And, you know, when someone's wanting to get into gymnastics, they really have to be small. And that enables them to be agile, and they don't have as much weight and mass to move. And she said, when she was 6 years old, that she just wanted to get into gymnastics. She was absolutely fascinated with it, and it was at that age that she was introduced for the first time to a gym. Now, before she was six, she already was doing flips and twists and splits and handstands. It was just something she was doing. She loved it. Well, she was absolutely thrilled when they took her to the gym for the first time. 6 years old, she was excited. There were the beams, all kinds of mats. She said, I was spending 6 hours a week, then 15 hours a week, or 20 hours, it grew to, in the gym. Just practicing, training. She felt like this is where she belonged, which it was where she belonged. And she was a very innovative child. Her mother found out she was doing performances at her school, and she would actually have the kids pay her to perform. Well, her mother didn't when she found out about that. She said, okay, you're not going to go into that. This is not appropriate behavior. She entered into competitions, and she won. Now, she said, this was really hard on my mom because my mother had to pay for a lot of training. Gymnastics is a very expensive sport. You have classes that you have to take. You have to learn choreography. There's leotards, wristbands, grips, tape, travel fees, the fees for the competition, and when she got injured, guess what? Dr. Bill, no big surprise there. Her siblings gave up their dancing lessons, figure skating lessons, everything to support Gabby. The whole family got involved in this and said, we want you to be able to do this. But she said she had an attitude. And her mother would constantly tell her, you need to change your thinking. You need to pay attention to how your mind works. A very wise mom. Now, when she was 14 years of age, she made the junior national team. They won the team gold in the 2010 Pan American Championships, and she took first place in the uneven bars. At that time, in that competition, she realized that she could compete in world competition. She was up to the task. But she'd have to have a coach who was going to enable her to achieve her dreams. The coach that she was really wanting to have was Liang Chao. And he had coached Shawn Johnson at the 2008 Beijing Olympics, and she won 4 medals, including gold on the beam. She said what she liked about him is that he wasn't stressed or tensed or yelling or screaming at any of his students. They were having a good time. And she said, I found out that he was going to do a gymnastics clinic in our area where we were living. And I went to it, and he taught her. He taught Gabby an Olympic-level vault in one afternoon. She goes to her mom. She said, I want him as a coach. Now, the coach, his place for training was in West Des Moines, Iowa, 1,200 miles away from home. Well, her mother didn't want her to go. She really didn't want to go. But finally, she acquiesced because she realized that this is the only way her daughter was going to be in competition. And she went into the gym. She said sometimes she got so homesick she got sick. But she said, I persevered. And of course, I had this extended family all around me. Now, this young lady said she set weekly goals, she visualized each of her routines, and she trained with focus and was so trusting of her coach because she knew that this is what it was going to take, what she'd been taught, so that she wouldn't succumb to abnormal pressures. Well, by God, she went through it. She said, you want to be the best. You have to give your best every time. Well, on July 18th, 2012, she went to London with 4 other members of the U.S. Women's Gymnastics team. And she said she was just thrilled. She loved London. And he said, we are going to push you in training beyond what may be expected of you in the Olympics. And she ended up being the individual all-around final 2 days later. And she said it was a change of a lifetime. Her score, their competition, The top score was 16. Hers was 15.966. She'd won the gold medal. And it wasn't given to her. It took her years to achieve this. I think that's what we need to remember. The freedoms that we're celebrating today, along with our hot dogs, hamburgers, and whatever else people might be having, the barbecues, the pleasure of interacting with friends, watching events on television, big celebrations, all of this was earned. And we have to remember, to maintain those freedoms, we have to be true to ourselves and to what we really know we have to do to maintain it. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Happy 4th of July to all of you. And we'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.